Witch with Chris Graham.
Welcome to the podcast, Chris Graham. I've actually got a voice which is very interesting. We're going to talk some Washington Nationals World Series baseball here on this particular podcast. And it's Thursday, Game 7 in the books. The Nationals win in, I'd say, dramatic fashion. It felt dramatic enough to me, 6-2, the final score. That's not dramatic, but in a game where they trailed 2-0, what felt like forever in that game. The Astros, as they did in, I think, every game of this series, had a lead after either one or two innings, getting to Max Scherzer early. And Scherzer, just like he did in game one, not the vintage Max Scherzer. He wasn't the dominating 20 strikeout guy, no hit bid guy, but he gritted it out. 5 innings, doesn't get the win, but he keeps his team in the game. Gives up 2 runs, strands 9 base runners. That was the biggest thing. Stranded at least a base runner every inning. Didn't have a 1-2-3 inning. 2 base runners from the second through the fifth. And it kept the game close. Zach Greinke pitched the game of his life. And I don't watch Zach Greinke every game. This is a guy who's won over 200 games in the big leagues and is probably going to be a Hall of Famer based on the metrics. But, you know, for where he is in his career now, and of course he won 18 games this year, so I'm probably selling him short even saying that way. But in this postseason, he'd come in with an 0-2 record, over 6 ERA, and hadn't gotten out of the fifth inning in his last 2 starts, including 1 start in the World Series. And he was masterful last night. Man, tell you what, watching that guy pitch when he's on his game like that is actually fun. I love watching good pitching. And Greinke was mixing in pitches ranging from 66 miles per hour all the way up to the low 90s. I think I saw maybe once or twice he touched 91 with his fastball. But that big slow curveball, the changeups in the 70s, and you know, mixing in fastballs that he wasn't even throwing at his maximum in the 90s. He'd throw some fastballs in the upper 80s, 87, 88 even. But he had the Nats off balance. And it's just a reminder that, you know, as much as we all love the radar gun, it's not about just throwing 98. You can throw 98 straight as a P, and you know, these major league hitters can hit it if they know it's coming. But Zach Greinke last night had Nats hitters just swing, you know, awkward swings all night long. But then after he got through the lineup twice, he gave up just 1 hit through the first 6 innings. And then in the 7th, after getting Adam Eaton out to lead off, the number 2 hitter in the Nats lineup, Anthony Rendon gets the first real mistake of the game from Greinke. A changeup left up in the zone and took it out of the park left field. And that's when you saw the Astros, who I still think, even though they lose this series, and you know, there was talk about this team, if they had won this series, that'd be 2 World Series in 3 years. They'd have 3 straight years of 100-plus wins. And you could start ranking them among some of the, you know, game's best teams, you know, long-term teams. I don't like the word dynasty because that implies that you win every year, and they wouldn't have won every year. But wait, you know, you start thinking about like the Yankees of the late 70s. You think of the big red machine, Cincinnati Reds of the mid-70s. The Baltimore Orioles for a stretch from the late 60s into the mid-70s. You know, teams like that, of course, I mean, the Yankees teams of the 40s and 50s, that's a different level. You know, you could put these Astros in a modern era where there's so much more competition, there's luxury tax, there's free agency. You know, to have a sustained run like this, this Astros team with one more win, you put them on that list. And this is why Zach Greinke being able to give you the game he gave you. But A.J. Hinch, the Astros manager, blinked. I don't have proof of this. I'm not John Smoltz, and I'm not sitting there on, you know, doing the game broadcast. I was yelling at the TV as we were going from the 6th to the 7th inning. You got to get rid of Greinke. As strong as he's been in this game, and I think through 6 innings he's thrown 67 pitches. He has had a problem in this postseason, as I mentioned, getting out of the 5th inning, and that issue was in those earlier starts, and that would include game 3 with the Nats, also back to what was it, game 4, maybe game 5. I think it was game 5 of the ALCS with the Yankees. He wasn't quite as efficient in terms of getting outs, and by the time he was in the fifth inning, he would already be starting the third time through the order. It was the third time through the order thing that was the real issue for him. And So great, you got six innings of one hit ball out of him. Be happy with that. You've got Gerrit Cole. AJ Hinch had him up in the bullpen twice, both in the fifth and sixth innings. And you go with Cole for a couple, and then get the ball to Roberto Osuna in the pen. And we found out later that wasn't the strategy at all. Anyway, the strategy actually from AJ Hinch was he planned to use Roberto Osuna in relief in mid innings, and then he was going to use Hinch Cole in the ninth if he had a lead to close things out, just a one inning save kind of situation. Okay, so that's the strategy. We found out after the game that was the strategy. He didn't go to Osuna though. After he takes Greinke out, he actually goes to Brad Peacock. Was that right? No, he actually went to Will Harris. And Harris had success against Howie Kendrick earlier in the series. And Kendrick talked about it afterwards. He felt like, I can't touch anything this guy throws. But after Greinke was taken out after walking Juan Soto, after the home run to Rendon, he walks Juan Soto, and that's the implosion. I mean, there's really not much there in terms of how much he'd lost it by that stage. It just happened so quickly. But then Kendrick comes up, and it's not a bad pitch from Harris, actually, not a bad pitch at all. 1-0 pitch that was off the plate. Not off the plate. It was right on the edge of the plate, maybe knees, outside corner. I'm seeing the as I'm talking here, I'm looking at the quadrant on the MLB at bat app. Good pitch. Kendrick went out and flicked the bat at it and got good contact on it. Mid-90s exit velocity, and the ball hit the foul pole in right field. Short porch. I mean, that's one of those situations. You don't have to hit 500-foot home runs all the time. This was not that, to say the least. And two-run homer, and just like that. I mean, we're talking about in a span of eight pitches, we go from Zach Greinke cruising with a one-hitter to the Nationals being ahead 3-2. And you could feel, of course, I'm watching the game on TV, didn't cover the game in Houston, but you could feel the air come out of Minute Maid Park. Because Astros fans, the way that game had played, the 2-0 lead, all the runners left on base, but it felt to me, I was in Nats Park for games 3, 4, and 5, and I know what that felt like. That felt like, I guess game 3 was a 4-1 loss, game 4 was an 8-1 loss, game 5 was a 7-1 loss, but those games were all, I want to say the game 4 loss, 8-1, it was 4-1 in the 7th. When the Nats bullpen imploded, it was 4-1 in the 8th, actually, in Game 5 when Daniel Hudson gave up a run in the 8th and then two more in the 9th. But even at 4-1 in those games, it did not feel like the way the game was playing, each of those games was playing, that the Nats had a chance to come back. And that's what it felt like for a long time last night, even just at 2-0. It just felt like, man, Greinke's won well. They'll get the ball to Cole. They'll get the ball to Osuna. And they'll win this game. And all of a sudden, before he could even get Osuna in there for the eighth inning, which I presume, I mean, without that having been said, that explicitly wasn't said by AJ Hinch. But, with him going to Harris in the seventh, you have to presume with one out, runner on base, what he's hoping to do is get Harris to get two outs there, get Osuna in the eighth with a 2-1 lead, and then you get the ball to Gerrit Cole ninth with a 2-1 lead, and you win the game. But he didn't get a chance because, again, maybe you outsmarted yourself there a little bit if you're AJ Hinch. And so the Nationals, though, and here's the interesting side of this. So, the embarrassment of riches that the Astros, on paper had in terms of bullpen strategy, the ability to have flexibility in terms of matchups. Davey Martinez actually went into game 7, I thought, with an advantage in this because Max Scherzer, who had to be scratched from his game 5 start, was able to come back. Miracles of modern medicine. We'll have to write about that at some point. And pitch game 7. And even though he wasn't Max Scherzer's dominant self, he gave you 5 innings. He ate them up. Kept you in the game despite, struggling mightily to get outs. Martinez still had – he actually had 2 guys that he could have gone to. He had both Anibal Sanchez – the game, your 4th starter. You also had Patrick Corbin, your 3rd starter, who's been used in relief an awful lot this postseason. And he goes to Corbin in the 6th and gets 3 great innings out of Corbin. I think he gave up 2 hits in total in those 3 innings, didn't walk anybody. and really put out the fire. As much traffic on the base paths as there was in Scherzer's five innings, 11 base runners. And he stranded them. I mean, you know, the Astros go 1-for-12 last night with runners in scoring position. But you get those quieting innings from Patrick Corbin. And then in the eighth, the Nats add another run. Osuna finally comes in the game in the eighth, and Washington scratches across a very important insurance run, a Juan Soto RBI single that makes the game 4-2. A little bit of breathing room because you're still wondering. You know, fans were watching at home, even writers in the ballpark, you wouldn't know what the situation might be in terms of what Davey Martinez is thinking in terms of who he's going to use. And how often, or how much, I should say. So, you know, we're just kind of watching along and, you know, waiting for the alert on our wristwatch. In my case, are they changing pitchers? And instead, you get another inning of Corbin in the eighth. And let's see, yeah, that was two outs in the top of the eighth when Soto got the single. And then you get another shutdown inning, a 1-2-3 inning, actually, out of Corbin, and in fact, that would have been, I think this is right. Yeah, that was the first 1-2-3 inning of the game for the Nationals pitchers. That is fascinating. Let me make sure that's right. Yeah, because there was a double play in the sixth. In the seventh, he faced four. Yeah, the eighth was the first 1-2-3 inning that the Nationals pitchers put in that game. I didn't realize that until just going through the play-by-play here. And then in the ninth, it's a 4-2 game, and at this point, really behind the eight ball, and Joe Smith comes in, and I like the usage of Joe Smith here. Smith is a sidearm righty, and you had Zimmerman, Gomes, Robles, Turner, the do up hitters, and you got to think, you know, this guy is so tough on right handed hitters, but Zimmerman singles, Gomes grounds into a fielder's choice, but then Robles singles, and Turner walks. And Hinch has to go back to the bullpen again. It goes to Jose Urquidy, who had pitched so well in Game 4. The spot starter got the win in that game. I think it was six innings. One or two hit ball and didn't allow a run. But he gives up an RBI single to Adam Eaton and two runs score. And it's 6-2 if you're a Nats fan. You're feeling pretty good at this stage. And then, so I mentioned, the eighth inning was the first 1-2-3 inning put in by Nats pitcher. A little surprised, certainly not critical at all because it worked, but a little surprised that Patrick Corbin didn't come back out for the ninth. Daniel Hudson comes out. Hudson came out and then Doolittle started loosening up in the bullpen just in case, but no need. Hudson gets the top of the order. George Springer, Jose Altuve, and Michael Brantley gets Altuve and Brantley striking out swinging. And the Nats bring home the World Series title. And what a moment! You know, the Howie Kendrick home run off the foul pole will live forever in Washington sports lore. Just like, I mean, in fact, we know that this postseason had so many of those moments. The Juan Soto bases clearing single in the wild card game. Nats were down 3-0 in that game. 3-1 in the eighth. Josh Hader, the Milwaukee closer, who in fact was honored as the NL reliever of the year. Ironically, in a ceremony at Nats Park, they honor both leagues' relievers of the year at the World Series, and Josh Hader had to come back to the scene of the crime. The reliever of the year gave up blew the save that allowed the Nats to continue their season. So the Juan Soto two-run single with a third run scoring on an error, and then there'd be the Kendrick Grand Slam. That came after a back-to-back homers in the eighth off Clayton Kershaw in Game 5 of the NLDS. Nats' first series win in franchise history that advanced Washington to the NLCS. Of course, that was a sweep. The Cardinals series, not a lot of dramatics unless you count Anibal Sanchez, 7 no-hit innings. Max Scherzer takes a no-hitter into the seventh in Game 2. Those were pretty dramatic moments, if you want to say. And then in the World Series, just a series full of them. And I know that this series didn't get the TV ratings that Fox, I'm sure, and MLB would hope for. But shame on those who didn't watch this World Series, even if you're just a casual baseball fan. First World Series you'll ever see and the last you'll ever see. I can almost guarantee that the home team does not win a game. Nats lose all three in Nats Park, much to my consternation. I was there for all three. But Washington wins all four in Minute Maid Park, a place where Houston had gone 60-21 in the regular season and lost all four games in a World Series. Could not close out Washington with coming back home with Justin Verlander and Zach Greinke, two guys who are going to be Hall of Famers. But they were outpitched by Steven Strasburg in Game 6, 8 1/3 innings. That's why he's the World Series MVP. He got two wins in this series, Games 2 and Game 6. And then Scherzer, again, not the dominant Scherzer, but the combination of Scherzer and Corbin. Man, that was some kind of win. And then you have Davey Martinez getting thrown out in Game 6, the first World Series manager ever thrown out in a game that his team wins. Last time a World Series ejection we'd seen was in Game 6 of the 1996 World Series, a very similar World Series in lots of ways. That was the series the Atlanta Braves won the first two games in New York, then lost to the Yankees in the three games that were played in Atlanta, and then Game 6 back in New York. Actually, New York was they closed it out with a 3-2 win, and Cox got thrown out for arguing a bad call. Well, it was a 3-2 game when the bad call happened in Game 6. You've heard lots about that. I've written about that, so I don't know if I need to belabor that point here in this podcast. But Martinez, actually, he didn't get thrown out in the immediate aftermath of the bad call on Turner at first base that took away what would have been a second and third nobody out situation in the top of the seventh of a 3-2 Nationals lead and turned it into a runner back on first base, one out situation, and then very next pitch, Adam Eaton pops up. So it's, you know, suddenly within a span of two pitches, you go from second and third nobody out to runner on first and two out. Anthony Rendon homers next at bat and made it 5-2. And that's when Martinez got thrown out. So he earned it. And very Earl Weaver like in that respect. It was quite the episode there, quite the scene there. But his team gets the win, and then in Game 7, outmaneuvers AJ Hinch, a World Series winning manager from a couple years ago. So much credit to Dave Martinez, Davey Martinez, for so much. I mean, what he did in this series, and this deserves a column. We'll talk about it here on the podcast. We'll write some more about it. But you know, we knew the strengths of this team. A very good lineup, one through seven, not a lot of easy outs. Victor Robles in the World Series, you know, not a lot of production, but man, you know, especially, and when you went to the DH, one through eight, a lot of production from that order, and that was the case most of the season. I mean, you know, Yan Gomes and Kurt Suzuki, what a great catcher tandem. You know, you had production from a lot of guys, Ryan Zimmerman, Asdrubal Cabrera, Howie Kendrick, Matt Adams at first and second. Those four guys, all very productive seasons this year. Trey Turner, a solid year at shortstop after he came back from his early season injury. Anthony Rendon, an MVP-type season. Juan Soto is a future MVP in the making. Robles during the regular season, solid season, a better wins above replacement, actually, than Bryce Harper. And so you look at that lineup, Adam Eaton, but what a great number two hole hitter that Adam Eaton is. You're starting pitching, such a strength of this team. The weakness we knew was the bullpen, and that's obvious. They were 30th and dead last as a result, being 30th in MLB in bullpen ERA this season, 30th in opponent batting average. Not a lot of fires put out, a lot of fires created by the bullpen. But so that's what you got. You can't change it. You know, you try. The Nats, it's not like Mike Rizzo didn't try. He made some offseason moves, tried to address issues. Those guys didn't work out. Tried to make some midseason moves. Daniel Hudson did work out, helping the back end of the bullpen, but still not a lot of help back there in general. And so what Davey Martinez did was he said, hey, we've got to be creative here. Wild card game was the first indication of that. But the wild card game, you see Max Scherzer get the ball. You see Steven Strasburg pitch three innings in relief. And that was key to that win. That trend continued into the NLDS. We're not going to win if we play conventionally straight up. Patrick Corbin was then turned into the guy that was used as a starter and reliever. Max Scherzer actually pitched an inning in Game 5, the clincher, in relief of Strasburg. Then, you know, you get to the NLCS, didn't need to do that as much, four-game sweep. You get to the World Series, though, and, you know, if you need to get Max Scherzer was up in the bullpen 2 days after missing his Game 5 start because of stiffness in his neck that prevented him from being able to put his own shirt on. 2 days later, he's in the bullpen warming up. He's a scheduled Game 7 starter, but if you need him, you need him. There's no Game 7 if you don't win Game 6, was the theory. And, you know, yeah, the use of Corbin last night for three innings, you know, you – again, the rules of baseball say you play a certain way, and Davey Martinez played Davey Martinez way. He managed this team to a World Series victory, and he never has to pay for a drink in Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, the DMV again, right? So what a moment. You know, we can talk in future podcasts, and we will, about off-season moves, That's for the future. This is right now. This is bask in the glory kind of moment for Nats fans and people like me who attended the games in D.C. You know, if you got to go to one, you got to go to, you know, a couple. I got to go to all three, very fortunately. And even with the losses, it was great to be in that environment. It wasn't the environment that we were told it was going to be, and I'm glad about that. You know, the ticket prices were so high that the fear was that the people buying the tickets were there more the corporate and political fat cat type people who, you know, aren't Nats fans, just kind of want to be there to be there. And I can tell you that the interactions I had for three solid days in D.C. at Nats Park and Half Street, the bullpen area, there were lots of people who I have to presume took out second mortgages on their homes. There were payment plans that you could put into effect, too. And we, in fact, did that. We are now proud season ticket holders for 2020, and that was actually a cheaper way to get tickets than it was to buy them straight up. So, you know, lots of folks there, lots of great stories, people who it was a lifelong dream to be able to go to a World Series game, and they're Nats fans, and so it was more special because they were at a World Series game with their team. And you know, seeing the pictures last night from TV, you know, it was pouring down rain in Northern Virginia, D.C. But people were at Nats Park. I understand they gave out 36,000 tickets, so close to capacity. Capacity there is about 43,000. They were close to capacity for people to sit out in the rain and watch it on the big screen. Amazing that's the case. And then not just that, but then there were thousands more out in front of Nats Park on Half Street leading up to the bullpen. The bullpen was a popular place. Looked like the bullpen. It was standing room only, packed like sardine kind of standing room only. Gosh, you know, part of me wishes I was there. It's a three-hour drive to get there to watch a baseball game on TV in the rain, but man, that looked like fun. And then I understand there were people, I didn't see pictures of this, but I understand that there were, you know, thousands more gathered out at the Capital One Arena area of the National Portrait Gallery, Chinatown area of D.C. Wonderful area of D.C. I love that part of town, too. You know, that kind of reprising the situation from back when the Caps were Stanley Cup champions a year ago, and folks would gather out there for that. Wow. You know, I'll say this about fandom. I've got friends, you know, I'm an unabashed political progressive for lots of reasons, and I won't go to them here. This is sports. I'm not going to stick to sports, but this is a sports podcast, and we'll talk politics and some other podcasts, but I am an unabashed political progressive, and a lot of my friends are as well. And, you know, there is a tendency, certainly, I mean, not everybody, but there is that you do find more people, I think, among political progressives who are either sports agnostic or anti-sports, even, you know, maybe more actively anti-sports. And I've got some good friends who are, you know, I think they're more anti-sports than sports agnostic, and, you know, feel like the attention and money put into sports is in American society is a problem. And, all I can say to people like that, and I think I've actually said this to a couple of my friends, what are you part of then? You know, what do you root for? I mean, I know that for some people, religion is that, and I don't know, sports is my religion. I love being part of something bigger and bigger than me. And, you know, this year for me, sports-wise, has been so interesting. I'm a UVA alum. UVA basketball writer. I've now co-written a book with Jerry Radcliffe. Very honored to have been approached by Jerry to co-write this book with him. It's been great sales, called Team of Destiny, about the UVA basketball national championship run from last year, 2018-2019. I was at the Final Four this year. I've walked on the floor after the championship. I picked up confetti off the floor that, you know, fell from the rafters there at US Bank Stadium in Minneapolis. And then 6 months later, I was at the World Series, watching games involving a team that was going to win a World Series, as it turns out. You know, what I'd say about both those experiences, they were great experiences personally for me. And then it was great being around people. I don't know if I certainly had a lot of fun myself. My wife was with me for both those trips. The first trip was a journalism trip, so she was actually in the stands and I was in the media bubble, so we weren't together for that. We were together, though, for the World Series. And great being able to share that experience. And, of course, for me, it was just personally so much fun. And I would say I was asked on a radio show. I do the Mark Moses radio show occasionally, a radio show a friend of mine does down in Florida. A great show. And he asked me, if a person is listening out there and they've never been to a World Series game, they're baseball fans, do you need to go to a World Series game? And I'd say yes, unequivocally, yes, just one. Hopefully involving your team. But, man, I tell you, as many regular season games as I've been to in my life, you know, you go to a regular season major league game and people are there, you're watching, you're looking for, your home runs, whatever, you're paying attention, you're paying half attention. You're also paying attention to your phone, you're buying beer, you're getting popcorn, you're getting a hot dog, you're going to the bathroom, you're doing all kinds of stuff. World Series game? I mean, we got there 3 hours early. Gates opened at 5 o'clock on Friday and Saturday for games 3 and 4. Game 5, they opened at 4 o'clock, 4 hours early. You get all that out of your system in the 3 or 4 hours before the game. When the game starts, you're watching baseball. You're watching every pitch, and everybody in the stadium is. Nats Park holds close to 44,000, just under 44,000. 44,000 sets of eyes watching baseball every pitch. Every pitch, like it's – I said this on that radio show. It's like it's Armageddon every pitch. And time stood still. The first two games ended after midnight. They started at 8 o'clock. They ended after midnight. The third one was quick. It was about 11:30. Quick, right? It did not feel like that. And I didn't want the night. I didn't want the games to end. I didn't want the night to end. I didn't want this. I still don't want the season to end. Who do you play now? Do you get to play the champion of Japan now? Come on, And I felt the same way after the UVA basketball championship. The Final Four. If you ever get to do that, again, hopefully it's involving your team. But man, when you go to a game, if you're a college, rabid college basketball fan like I am, you go to a game involving your team. You go to JPJ. I'm talking to a largely UVA fan base, I assume, based on our metrics. when you go to JPJ for a game, there's 15,000 people there, and when UVA scores, 99.9% of them are cheering, and when UVA doesn't score, we're upset, and when we're playing defense, 99.9% of you are trying to make it hard for the other team. When you're at the Final Four, there's 15,000 people at JPJ. There were 72,000 people at the Final Four. They play them in football stadiums. So especially on championship game night, I don't know how this is. It was what it was. There's 72,000 people there. 36,000 are rooting for UVA. 36,000 the night I was there were rooting for Texas Tech. So whenever UVA scores, 36,000 people are cheering. Whenever Texas Tech scores, 36,000 people are cheering. That's the case for 2.5 hours. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I could not believe how intense that was. And the World Series, same way. Even in the World Series games I went to were not competitive. The Nats were, and I never felt like they were really in any of those games. But still, it was that intense. I can only imagine what it would have been like if it was a tie game in the ninth, or bases loaded, two down in the ninth, closer versus Rendon or Soto, 3-2 game. If we get a hit, we win. If we don't, we lose. I mean, I can only imagine what that would have been like, how intense that would have been, because it was intense, and it wasn't like the scores weren't like that. Do it. And the bigger than you part of this that I love is, when we were at the Final Four, we're in Minneapolis. We're halfway across the continent from Charlottesville. And you walk down the street with a V hat on, orange and blue one, and all of a sudden you've got something to talk about because you see somebody else wearing the same colors. And then you come back. I mean, I ran into somebody at a charity fundraiser that my wife and I attended a few weeks ago who I know a little bit, someone I'm conversant with and like and admire, but I don't see very often. And I wouldn't say we're friends just because we don't call each other and that kind of thing. But we both knew that each of us had been to the Final Four. And so for 30 minutes, we talked about that. It's bigger than you. It's something like that, shared experiences. And You know, I the same thing with the World Series and with the Nats, and being a part of something bigger like that is so cool. You know, it's bigger than you. It's so fun to see. And you know, also I would say what's fun is, you know, family of ours who aren't necessarily baseball fans, sports fans, even necessarily the more sports agnostic types. We're getting messages on social media while we're in D.C. We're watching the games. They say, rooting for the Nats. Crystal's mother came to visit us here at the home office today, and she was, you know, I wouldn't say she's a hardcore baseball fan to say the least, but she went to bed and the score was 6-2, and she woke up and the Nats still won. You know, she fell asleep. I shouldn't say went to bed, fell asleep before the game ended, but knew the Nats were going to win, and was talking to me about various plays in the game, and wow, that's amazing to me that you know it's bigger than you. So. That's what sport. That's why we watch. That's why we stick our heart into it. It gets broken some. It gets broken a lot. You know, there's only one champion at the end of a season. There's 30 Major League Baseball teams. There's 353 Division I basketball teams. 130 Division I FBS football teams. And only one team at the end of any of those seasons is the champion. And it doesn't happen very often to your favorite team. I mean, you know, even 11 New York Yankees fans who say we've won 27 championships. Most of those were before we were born. And that's okay. That's fine. I'm good with you. You want to claim some stuff there. But you know, for by and large, you know, when your season ends, it's, hey, it's been fun. And we'll try again next year. Those rare years when your team wins a championship, man, those are the ones you remember. I know I'll remember this year for me. As a UVA basketball fan, as a Washington Nationals baseball fan, 30 years from now, when I'm sitting in a nursing home eating you know, pureed food, I will, back in 2019, that was a pretty good year, wasn't it, Crystal baby? That'll be the kind of thing we'll be remembering for a long, long time. And next year will be fun, too. Actually, for me, I thought about this and I tweeted it out last night. Basketball season, college basketball season anyway, starts next week. UVA plays at Syracuse. How interesting that the championship game was, what, April 8th? NCAA basketball championship game was April 8th. Baseball season had already started. It was about a weekend at that point. That's how long ago that's been. The whole baseball season happened. For the next 12 months, I tweeted, I get to watch UVA basketball and Washington Nationals baseball now that I'm a season ticket holder. I get to watch the defending national champions and the defending world champions. Those are the two teams I root for, write about, invest myself in. I'm a lucky sports fan. For the next year, I mean, this year was great because, hell, I guess dating back to this time last year, actually, when you think about it, because we didn't know it at the time. But this around this time last year, UVA basketball was getting ready to win a national championship. They were taking that long path towards a national championship. And then in May and in April, the Nationals started their trek. So this past 12 months has been fun. In the next 12 months, I don't care if UVA basketball doesn't make the – well, I shouldn't say that. They're going to make the NCAA tournament. But I don't care if they don't win a game in the NCAA tournament. I don't care if the Nats don't make the playoffs. It's hard to make the baseball playoffs. Because for the next 12 months, I'm writing about and rooting for defending champions. And this is a fun year. I'm not taking for granted that it's not going to be the case all the time. It's not going to be the case all the time. But, man – Fun. So, take a breath now. That's the thoughts on the Nationals. And I'm sure Jerry Carter, when we have him, he serves as such a really solid co-host for our shows twice a week, Mondays and Fridays. He will ask me more about these topics when we get together tomorrow. And also today, if you haven't listened to this one already, I am recording a UVA football podcast. We'll get you ready for UVA UNC. That one probably won't be as long as this one. We're over a half hour, obviously, on this one. It might be 15 or 20 minutes, but we'll get you ready for UVA UNC. I've got to turn my mind back to football. I've also got a VMI football broadcast to work on this weekend, VMI hosting Western Carolina at Foster Stadium on Saturday. So a busy Saturday for me. I get tonight off, tomorrow night off, and then back to the grind on Saturday, 1:30 kickoff at Foster Stadium in Lexington. I'll be on the radio doing that broadcast with Rick Cruz. And then UVA football is at 7 o'clock, and I'll be I'll be live blogging and then covering that game, of course, afterwards as well. So a lot coming up there in the sports world. A couple of days off to bask in the glow of another championship. So thank you for joining us here on the podcast, and we will talk to you again soon.